Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present former Marine and UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter, who takes a critical look at the Bush administration's justification for war and the current U.S. occupation of Iraq. John Gershman, senior analyst with the Interhemispheric Resource Center, who assesses the effectiveness of Bush administration policies countering terrorism on the second anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks. And Josh Silver, managing director of the group Free Press, who looks at a recent court ruling that temporarily blocked the Federal Communications Commission plan to deregulate the nation's broadcast media. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Guardian newspaper reports that anti-globalization activists, tongue-in-cheek, asked Mexican security officials to expand its watch list at the September meeting of the World Trade Organization in the resort city of Cancun. In August, the Mexican daily newspaper La Reforma revealed that 80 anti-WTO activists from Mexico and abroad were on a security list and were under surveillance. Hundreds of international social justice advocates who later traveled to Cancun demanded to be put on the watch list. They have signed a letter titled, Government Agents Bent on Restricting Civil Liberties. The letter states, if you are unwilling to add my name to the list, then I must insist that you remove those singled out for special attention. I can assure you that we have similar views. We are all opposing the WTO and a free trade agenda that impoverishes the majority of us while enriching a few corporations. Tens of thousands of Mexican and international opponents of neoliberal policies advocated by the World Trade Organization who descended on Cancun have been met by a heavy police presence. Mexican authorities have vowed to prevent a shutdown of the trade meeting as occurred in Seattle in 1999. In the weeks after the September 11, 2001 terror attacks, Attorney General John Ashcroft gained access to the personal records of 300 million Latin American citizens from Mexico, Brazil, Argentina, Colombia, and Guatemala. The data mine came courtesy of Choice Point, the infamous Atlanta firm that was implicated in the 2000 presidential election purge of black voters in Florida. In what later became a scandal for Mexican President Vicente Fox, Ashcroft and the new Homeland Security Department had current Mexican voter registration lists, Mexico City driver's licenses dating back to 1997, and updated automobile registration records for the same period. So far, Choice Point has not revealed how it obtained the database of Mexican citizens, and Mexico's Attorney General has launched an investigation. The vehicle registration lists are believed to come from the now-defunct National Automobile Registry, whose former director, Ricardo Cavallo, has been extradited to Spain on charges of genocide during Argentina's dirty war. The data scandal has revived fear among Mexicans that the U.S. Border Patrol or private bounty hunters will knock down doors in Mexico City looking for fugitives. As Julio Tello, a professor at Monterey Technological Institute, who wrote Mexico's database protocol, explained, this is a violation of personal privacy and political rights. Now, it's not just telemarketers, but the FBI has your phone number, too. Atlanta homeowner Maria Flores is deep in debt. To keep up with the payments, her finance company, a division of Citigroup, advised her to take out another mortgage on her home. She ended up paying 18% interest on the new loan, something community activists call predatory lending. According to Mother Jones magazine, Citigroup makes big profits off moderate-income consumers by charging sky-high interest rates on home mortgages and personal loans. In 2002, City Financial, the division that includes subprime lenders, made a $1.3 billion profit, nearly 10% of all Citigroup's earnings. In recent years, Citigroup has been sued by consumers complaining they were trapped into paying high-priced loans. Publicly, the financial giant says it ended predatory lending, yet it has only converted 110 of its 25,000 customers who now pay high-priced subprime loans to lower-priced market rates for which they qualify. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
As violence continues to consume U.S.-occupied Iraq, President Bush addressed the nation on September 7th to explain his administration's policies there and request $87 billion for the pacification and reconstruction of both Iraq and Afghanistan. Although the president conspicuously omitted any mention of the U.S. failure to capture Osama bin Laden or to locate any of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction used by his administration to justify its war, he maintained that Iraq was now the central front in the war against terrorism. As he has many times before, the president linked the September 11th terrorist attacks against the U.S. to the toppled regime of Saddam Hussein, despite the lack of any evidence connecting Iraq with the al-Qaeda network. Acknowledging the fact that his administration's go-it-alone approach was not working, Mr. Bush also announced a new initiative to ask for soldiers and money from United Nations member states to stabilize Iraq. Scott Ritter is a former Marine intelligence officer and UN weapons inspector who served in Iraq for 7 years before resigning in 1998. In the months before the U.S. invasion, Ritter had publicly challenged the Bush administration's contention that Baghdad's weapons systems posed a grave risk to the U.S. and necessitated a war. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Scott Ritter about the Bush administration's justification for war and the U.S. occupation of Iraq, detailed in his new book titled Frontier Justice, Weapons of Mass Destruction and the Bushwhacking of America.
The president tried to convince the American public that, you know, what is happening today, circa September 2003, is a direct result of the events of September 11th, 2001, as though there is a continuum there. When in fact, the reality is that there is no linkage between Saddam Hussein's regime, the one that we have overthrown, and those who perpetrated those horrific attacks on the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and other airplane that was hijacked and crashed in the fields of Pennsylvania. You know, the president didn't lay out the fact that the reason why we find ourselves waging this struggle is because of his own failed policies. Now, you wouldn't expect him to say that, but you wouldn't expect him to assume that the American public is as ignorant as anyone who listened to that speech and accepted at face value would have to be. This was not a war in Iraq that we had to fight. It was very much an elective war, a war that the president elected to fight, and he did so under false pretense. He told the American public that we were at threat from weapons of mass destruction. This threat has yet to materialize. It appears that, you know, his administration exaggerated the case for war. And, you know, now that we have troops deployed in harm's way, we can't just simply cut and run. So we are in for the fight. But the fight that's being fought in Iraq is not a fight that would have been fought had we not invaded. If we didn't invade Iraq, there wouldn't be a war against terror in Iraq, because Saddam Hussein's regime, as terrible as it was the antithesis of the Islamic fundamentalist anti-American regime. It was a secular regime that was readily contained by the United Nations and a program of sanctions and weapons inspections. And now what we have is a nation of 23 million caught up in chaos and anarchy that is derived from our own actions. We're unable to rally the world behind us to contain this. And it's a magnet now for those who have a gripe against the United States. And the president didn't say this. I'm hopeful that many Americans will look through his rhetoric and realize that this is a man who has yet to recognize that he's to blame.
Could you comment on the unfolding scandal in Britain over Tony Blair and his government's involvement in exaggerating the threat coming from Iraq, and how that may spill over and affect the Bush presidency here?
I personally am enthralled with the concept of Tony Blair being held accountable for his words and his actions. I'm heartened that a democracy can say, we stand for something greater than the office of the prime minister. We stand for the rule of law. We stand for values and ideals that do not accept an elected representative lying to their people. Now, here in the United States, there seems to be a greater willingness on the part of the people of the United States, according to polls, to give the president a break. Tragically, I feel that many Americans would accept the fact that the president misled them or lied to them, distorting the threat posed by Iraq. If we had gone in there, booted Saddam Hussein out with relatively few casualties, and we were treated as liberators, and our boys and girls were home now, I think Americans would say, well, who cares about the weapons? That guy's a bad man. We found the mass graves, etc. But the problem is, they're not home. And they're starting to come home, more and more of them, tragically, in body bags, or mutilated, or destroyed psychologically by the effects of war. In addition to this, we're suddenly faced with this huge price tag, $1 billion a week, and it's going to go up double or triple in the weeks and months to come. Who's paying for that? The American public is. And now people are going to say, hey, the economy's faltering. We got this expensive war. We got Americans dying. Why is this occurring? And at that point in time, they will be compelled to come back to the weapons of mass destruction issue. And at that moment, they will realize that all of these bad things are happening because the president lied to them. And then, and sadly only then, will they have a chance to reflect on what that means for democracy as a whole, American democracy. And hopefully the president will go through the same sort of heat that Tony Blair is right now.
If securing the United States from an imminent threat, as they described it, was not the motivation for the Bush administration policy in invading Iraq, what was, in your view?
What you need to do to answer that question is dissect who populates the senior-most decision-making hierarchy positions in the Bush administration and what motivates them. What is their stated ideology? And you will find that somewhere around 90% of these senior positions are held by people who have an affiliation with the Project for a New American Century, which is a neoconservative think tank. And their ideology has been stated clearly several times in writing. It's global hegemony. It's the United States of America imposing its will preemptively, if necessary, on the world where we find our national security to be at risk. It's that we will take advantage of the collapse of the former Soviet Union to leverage our overwhelming military and economic power to our benefit. We will walk away from multilateralism. We will walk away from the United Nations, and this will become an America-only world. These people believe in Plato's The Noble Truth, where they are empowered with the noble truth, the vision that says, America is just, America is right, and the world must follow our path. And here we stumbled on stage one. We've gone into Iraq, and we've stumbled. We've stubbed our toe. We're not going anywhere else. It's a disaster. The neoconservative vision of the Project for New American Century is fluttering away. The Bush administration has to go, hat in hand back to the United Nations to beg for help. But the tragedy is, this is something that anybody who had subjected their vision to a fair and open debate would have been able to ascertain for themselves. It would have been nice if we had the informed consent of the American people regarding Iraq. It would have been nice if the Congress of the United States had asked the tough questions and demanded the tough answers. It would have been nice if the American media had done that. But instead, everybody just bought into the rhetoric of the Bush administration, especially after September 11, 2001, where the Bush administration was very effective in exploiting the ignorance and fear of the American public to push this agenda. And that's what's going on. Iraq was never a threat to the United States of America. Iraq was the easiest target to pick for a major playing out of the neoconservative agenda of global hegemony.
That was Scott Ritter, a former Marine intelligence officer and United Nations weapons inspector. His book, Frontier Justice, Weapons of Mass Destruction and the Bushwhacking of America, is published by Context Books. As Americans observe the second anniversary of the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon that killed some 3,000 people, President Bush's preemptive military actions in Afghanistan and Iraq are meeting heavy resistance. Forces connected with Afghanistan's Taliban government, toppled by the U.S., have regrouped and are now conducting regular attacks against U.S. and Afghan government soldiers, as well as aid workers from around the world. In Iraq, guerrilla assaults on U.S. and British soldiers have killed and wounded an increasing number of troops, while deadly bombings have targeted United Nations headquarters, a Shiite holy shrine, and the Jordanian embassy. Victims of the attacks have included top UN diplomat Sergio de Mello and powerful Shia cleric Mohammed Bakir al-Hakim. At the same time, sabotage of Iraq's oil production and utility infrastructure has deprived the war-torn nation of basic services and desperately needed revenue. President Bush recently told the nation that, "We are fighting that enemy in Iraq and Afghanistan today so that we do not meet him again on our own streets, in our own cities." On the second anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks, many Americans are asking themselves if the Bush administration's foreign and domestic policies have made the nation safer and less vulnerable to future terrorist strikes. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Gershman, senior analyst with the Interhemispheric Resource Center, who assesses the effectiveness of President Bush's initiatives to counter terrorism.
We have compounded the tragic criminal atrocity that was September 11th now with a new round of atrocities, and that September 11th and the immediate international response to the attacks of September 11th really provided us with a new opportunity, us meaning, you know, the United States and its citizens. There was this clear outpouring of international solidarity for the citizens of the U.S. that had been attacked, and that famous Le Monde headline, you know, we're all Americans now. What was this voice of, well, here's now an opportunity for the United States to come forward, to exercise leadership, and to really go after the roots of terrorism in a constructive, multilateral, internationalist fashion, and represented an opportunity for U.S. citizens. You know, we all remember the lines of people waiting to donate blood and everything like that, an opportunity for us to forge a new vision of what the United States could be. And that opportunity has been squandered. We've now seen the war on terrorism be used to justify a series of military interventions and a war in Iraq, expanding military aid to large numbers of authoritarian countries. We see now the United States choosing to totally diss the United Nations, and although now they may have to go back on that partially, and the articulation of a doctrine of preventive or preemptive war, which is the kind of doctrine that elevates the United States in part as its, you know, ability to engage in aggressive warfare to effectively launch terrorist actions of its own. And all of that, I think, represents a real squandered opportunity to forge a new direction in U.S. foreign policy, certainly U.S. domestic policy, erosion of civil liberties and so forth. The tragedy of the atrocity of 9/11 has been compounded by the policies of the Bush administration, and that makes it a doubly hard anniversary to kind of witness.
After the U.S. wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and the USA Patriot Act here at home and the erosion of civil liberties, are we safer now? Are there things in place now that prevent another terrorist attack such as September 11th, which, of course, is the basis for all these policies coming out of the White House?
Right. There are certain things that have made us more secure in terms of homeland security. There is stricter security around container shipping, for example. There is stricter security at ports and other ports of entry. There's greater scrutiny of visa applications. A whole number of things that have effectively pushed the borders of the United States outward, yes, has made us a bit more secure. And those are, you know, I think have to be acknowledged as things that many people had been talking about throughout the 90s as things that should be done, and it required an attack like 9/11 for them to actually take place. I think the thing that's most troubling is that there have been many other steps taken that make us less secure. The articulation of a doctrine of preventive war, for example, the expansion of military aid to large numbers of authoritarian regimes, which can in turn spawn a blowback of terrorism directed against the United States. Certainly the war in Iraq has created Iraq as a front line of the war on terrorism, because now jihadis from around the region are using the Iraq war as an opportunity to go after the occupation troops. As former Clinton administration counterterrorism official Jessica Stern mentioned in an op-ed in the New York Times a while ago, the United States, by invading and occupying Iraq in the way that it did, the United States turned a country that did not pose a terrorist threat to the United States and turned it into a country that now does. While we have made some accomplishments in terms of, you know, airport security, border security, and so forth, certainly in the medium to long term, the kinds of policies that the Bush administration are pursuing are creating new potential enemies. And that is those things that I think in the medium to long term will overrun whatever positive steps we've taken in other areas.
Do you have a prescription that you think would have been better targeted and more effective at attacking the roots of terrorism?
Myself and some other colleagues at Foreign Policy in Focus are finishing putting together a revised version of our alternative agenda to combat terrorism. The Bush administration is willing to provide, you know, $87 billion now for an occupation of a country. That $87 billion is roughly four times what the State Department's core budget is for administration and foreign aid. And so if the United States is serious about addressing the root political and socioeconomic causes that allow terrorism to emerge and thrive, it needs to put money not just into funding a repressive occupation in Iraq, but it needs to address the socioeconomic and political inequalities that are enabling environments for terrorism. And the Bush administration has shown no sign to be willing to do that, and instead is willing to promote tax cuts for the wealthy and to enrich a small number of corporations like Halliburton and Bechtel in the Iraqi occupation. And so, you know, by strengthening international law and human rights, by promoting and supporting democracy and human rights abroad, by addressing severe inequalities and injustices and poverty, and by trying to strengthen international law as opposed to holding oneself above it, all would have been, I think, more appropriate steps that would have addressed the real threat that terrorism does pose, and while at the same time would address both the short-term and medium and long-term conditions that lead to it.
That was John Gershman, senior analyst with the Inter-Hemispheric Resource Center and co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus. Read his articles online at www.fpif.org. A three-judge panel of the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia acted on September 3rd to temporarily block the Federal Communications Commission from implementing new rules which abandoned regulations that had restricted the concentration of ownership of the nation's print and broadcast media outlets. The June 2nd vote by a majority of GOP-appointed FCC commissioners, led by Chair Michael Powell, allowed media corporations to reach up to 45% of the national TV audience, up from 35%, and lifted the prohibition on one company from owning a newspaper and television station, or multiple TV stations, serving the same market. The court decision was made in reaction to a lawsuit filed by the Prometheus Radio Project, a group which promotes the expansion of low-power FM stations. The judges issued the stay, which could remain in force until late November, in order to review the impact of the new FCC rules on the public interest. The FCC's recent move to deregulate the nation's media, widely expected to increase the concentration of ownership of TV, radio, and publishing companies, spawned the growth of a national grassroots movement to oppose the rule changes and advocate for increased diversity on the airwaves. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Josh Silver, managing director of the group Free Press, who looks at the significance of the FCC court ruling and the growing strengths of groups working to reform the U.S. media system.
During the wintertime, Michael Powell, the son of Secretary of State Colin Powell, announced that he was planning on making some changes to the laws that govern how media is owned and bought and sold in America. He intentionally did it really under the cover of war. This was a time when the United States was heading towards the conflict in Iraq, and much like has been done with the FCC, such as in 1996 in the Telecommunications Act, when upwards of $70 billion, depending on who you listen to, dollars worth of spectrum was given away to corporations. His assumption was, with good reason based on history, that he could pass these deregulations sort of in the quiet when no one was looking, and that everything would be quite smooth as he kind of works his way up the political food chain. But what happened on June 2nd and the months leading up to it was just unbelievable. Over 2.3 million Americans lodged complaints to the FCC and Congress protesting his moves to do essentially three major things. One thing the FCC was working to do was expand the number of television stations that one company could own, expanding the number of percentage of the American audience from 35% to 45%. Another is getting rid of a rule that prohibits a major daily newspaper from owning radio and television stations. And another rule is one that prohibits one television company from owning more than one major TV station in a market. We saw a groundswell of opposition that absolutely staggered everyone from Michael Copps, the leading FCC commissioner who's led the fight against the rule changes, to members of Congress. What we saw in the court case last week, a federal appeals court in Philadelphia decided that the possible detriment of these rule changes, which were to take effect on September 4th, were irreversible and could cause permanent and irreparable damage to our democracy. This is a big deal. Now, let's be clear. The court did not decide that the rules were unconstitutional or that they need to be reversed, but they did order a crucial temporary stay which prohibited the mergers from occurring as intended by Michael Powell.
Josh, tell us a little bit about free press and the coalitions being developed around the country to tackle our media problem.
Congress understands that the people don't want these rule changes, that they stand to benefit no one. Literally, no one in this country stands to benefit other than the major media companies. What we're looking at now, you've got several approaches being embarked upon by Congress. The one that stands a chance of surviving, actually passing, is through the Senate and House Appropriations Committee. The only way to get legislators to come in on the right side of this issue is by getting the public to weigh in and make their voices heard. There's no way we can match the media lobby dollar for dollar. And that's what free press is about. We come at this from the argument that media policies have been made for decades behind closed doors by special interests, much like many other policies in this country. And it's time for those media policy-making processes to come out and see the light of day. We have the first full-time media lobby working Capitol Hill, and we are working with lots of other partner organizations to get media onto the agenda of other organizations. The logic is, no matter what issue you care about, whether it's the environment or women's rights or civil rights, that you have to make media your second issue. It's not going to be your first issue, but you got to make it your second issue, and you have to address it, because if you don't have a diverse and independent and competitive and skeptical media, you're not going to get the information that you need to learn about the issue and to convince others that your issue deserves attention. Listeners who care about this need to plug in the next few weeks, because this is when we need to get every person in this country to weigh in on the petition, which is on our website, and to call your legislator, call your senator, and it really does work. Some people are skeptical, but if you get involved, changes will happen.
That was Josh Silver, managing director of the group Free Press. To find out more about the nation's media reform movement, call Free Press toll-free at 1-866-666-1533. Or visit their website at www.mediareform.net. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer-Cousineau.